This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network for 10 years. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
As the news of coronavirus reverberates throughout the world, we at HRN are especially concerned about how coronavirus will impact our food system. We will use our platform to support the restaurant, agriculture, hospitality, and other food-related industries by maintaining our coverage and operations. As social distancing becomes the temporary norm, podcasts are more important than ever. There's never been a more crucial time to stay informed about the state of our food system and the ways that food connects our global community. We're sharing all of our COVID-19 coverage at heritageradionetwork.org/COVID-19, from interviews with nonprofit leaders and journalists, to firsthand accounts from chefs and restaurant owners, to reports on how this crisis is affecting regional farms. Our team is working remotely from all over to keep food radio alive. HRN needs your support more than ever to keep sharing essential stories and resources with our listeners. Make a donation of any amount. Visit heritageradionetwork.org/donate.
Welcome to HRN Happy Hour. It's 5 o'clock somewhere, and somewhere is, for me, Alabama. Where's everybody else?
Rhode Island.
Representing Connecticut.
New Jersey.
Massachusetts.
And our guest today is Jake Cohen. Jake, where are you?
I'm in New York City. I'm still here.
Nice.
Oh my God.
The last holdout.
Left behind.
Yep.
I feel like we've
It's funny because I'm born and raised in New York, so it's I see like everyone going to like their childhood homes and moving back in with the parents for a while, and like I also live in the same building as my mother and my sister, so there was really like nowhere to go.
Yes.
That's awesome though. So, Jake, as I said, Jake is our guest today. Jake is the editorial and test kitchen director of The Feed Feed, and you may recognize his voice because he is one of the hosts of The Feed Feed podcast here on HRN. And, Jake, you just finished up season one, is that right?
Correct. Yeah.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
How has being a host of a podcast been going? I mean, you're like such a natural on video for the feed, but how has being a podcast host been and how has it been different for you?
I think it's really been so nice and relaxing in the same sense of you think of someone who's a content creator, especially in food media, everything is so visually driven. So it's about photos, videos, the food all looks gorgeous. Even if it's like approachable and supposed to look rustic, it's rustic but still gorgeous. And the podcast is kind of this first time where you get to talk to these kind of huge names in food media and hear more so about like, how did they get there? What is their thought process behind the recipe? How do they make things look gorgeous? What are the kind of like emotional breakdowns they've had as they've tried to build up their career? And these are all people that like have been idols of mine, idols of most of the feed audience. Many of our editors like freak out because I'll try, since our test kitchen is only 2 blocks away from Heritage Radio at Roberta's, I try to like bring big names back to the office just to introduce them to everyone. And I remember when I brought Deb Perlman of Smitten Kitchen into the office, people like lost their shit. And I was just talking to her about the fact that she does everything on her own and she doesn't really know what's next. She just wants to cook whatever she wants. And it's kind of getting that full view of someone in food. And we just recorded our first 2 episodes of season 2. Both of them, the first episode's with Gail Simmons from Top Chef, and the second episode's with David Leibowitz, the cookbook author. And their stories are especially just like so interesting to see how they got to where they are and the kind of like just how everything fell into place, and they've obviously worked really hard and are such incredible masters of their craft in terms of, on David's case, like writing cookbooks and doing these deep dives into a subject and conveying that to the home cook. On Gail's side of like being the liaison for restaurants, but to hear like their stories of what they were like or what it was like at the very beginning is just so, so empowering, inspirational, all the things that you kind of want and need to be hearing right now.
Yeah, I was just curious, as you know, over the past month, you've had to, you and the Feed team have had to shift, you know, away from the beautiful test kitchen and event space that you have and create all this content a little bit more remotely. Of course, you know, I feel like Feed is similar to Patreon in that we're very lucky in that we are digital platforms and can keep doing what we're doing. But how have things changed for you sort of operationally and logistically?
Yeah, I mean, luckily we're on Slack, so it's just we are talking every morning, connecting, seeing what everyone's going down. I think the key part is that this is actually a busier time for most food publications, which is an interesting conversation because at the same point, you also have to have a larger look at what the food industry is like as a whole and what companies are kind of advertising at this time and what is appropriate versus not. And right now, our entire focus is just on empowering our audience as they are in this new normal in the same way that we are. So that's providing them with recipes that are a combination of what are the aspirational things that they want to learn now that they have the time, and what are the kind of go-to pantry recipes that they can make with stuff they probably already have in their cupboards. I think we're trying to be as diverse as our audience is and at the same time be super respectful to the climate.
Jake, this is Katie. I have a question for you. Thinking back to January of 2020, before it became clear that COVID-19 was going to be the thing that shook up our entire media formatting and life in general, Vogue did their January 2020 issue of the magazine with no photographs. And this was, sorry, I should say Italian Vogue. So this was the Italian Vogue,
yeah, where for with the white sustainability,
color. Yep, they did all the fashion shoots instead of having an actual photo shoot. They had artists, you know, doing paintings and other kinds of like displays of fashion without actually having to photograph them. And this was for reasons of sustainability at the time. And there was a lot of conversation about airplane flights. And so, you know, kind of switching away from the big produced photo shoot was done for a different reason. But suddenly, you know, that seeming like something that might become a little bit more popular now for like a visual food media format in particular. Have you seen that starting to happen, or do you see applications for the Feed with something like that?
I mean, 100%. The fact is we were already kind of just built on that since so many of our contributors, content creators that we work with so closely are people that work for themselves or work from home, and food is not necessarily their full-time job, or if it is their full-time job, they're doing it remotely. So we've been lucky in the sense that, and as someone who has worked at kind of big food publications that have had these insane shoots, both for digital as well as the concept of just thinking back when I was at Suburban Magazine of what would go into our cover shoots was insane. And it's so important because you have to think about this as an industry that's based on selling a magazine, and the cover is what is going to get someone to pull it off the shelf. And it seems wasteful to have all this for a photo shoot, but at the same time, that is what will potentially sustain a huge number of people's jobs and potentially create more. However, we're moving into this very low budget. People just want to, they don't need pretty food. They don't need those gorgeous kind of spreads. They just need to see something that looks like what they're going to cook for dinner. And as long as it's not like satirically ugly, it's fair game. I think a perfect example of that is the New York Times, Susan Spungen, who was actually on the first episode of the Feed Feed podcast, who's an incredible cookbook author and food stylist, is not only just she's a constant stylist for the Times, she's styling the food and shooting it now for the magazine. So this is a woman who, I mean, again, I could be totally wrong, but I would assume that she's using her iPhone and she's styling photos and now using iPhone pics, and that's what's going in the New York Times.
That's incredible. And it's like, for somebody who's never worked in the publishing industry, can you talk about like a Sidver cover shoot and what went into that and what that looked like?
Well, you would have a photographer who would have a very large budget, because they're bringing all the equipment, cameras, lighting set up. They would have at least an assistant, if not two. We had in-house props, but that would involve like the art team being present, and they're the ones who are setting up what is the surface, what are the props, what are the color schemes, where is there going to be room for text, are we using the props that we have or are we renting props? I can actually give another great example after this, but then you in the kitchen have, like, I would typically be assigned to assist whatever the food stylist was. So it would be this big name food stylist who would come in with these gorgeous groceries that they would hand select from Eataly, and create these whatever dishes we're trying for the cover. And the whole thing would take hours and hours in terms of, like, I remember there's this one shoot with fried chicken where literally we probably spent an hour just like rotating three pieces of fried chicken, and we went through every potential combination of all the chicken fried just to see which one. So it's just a huge to-do. Another great example is right before we actually wrapped, the day New York on Pause got put into place, I just shot my cookbook at Feed Feed, actually, and that was like the same sort of production where it was myself and a team, and it was a photographer with an assistant, a prop stylist who handled sourcing and renting all of the props, a food stylist with an assistant. I had another two assistants, and of course this is for shooting 100 recipes in 6 days, so you need that kind of team. But just to think about the money that goes into the prop rentals, the food itself, the rental for the equipment, for the actual photography, in addition to the fact that everyone needs to get paid because this is their livelihood. It's what goes into a photo is a lot. And it's always been that way. So it'll be interesting to see how things go. I know a lot of like publishers are now leaning on cookbook authors that also shoot. There's that kind of like blogger. There was that blogger push of just giving bloggers cookbook deals because you can give them a small advance, as well as have them shoot and style their own cookbook. So it's just logistically much easier. And I think that's probably that had like a huge push. Then it kind of went away because the books are typically garbage since they look pretty, but you have to be so much more selective when you're dealing with content creators because they need to have been vetted by so many different kind of ways. When you think of people who kind of go the traditional route to write a cookbook and sell a proposal, they typically have not even accolades, but they have bylines and publications that require that they have some sort of clout when it comes to recipe development and their testing and their writing. So it's always been the kind of trade-off between content and aesthetic. And I think now we're in a time in which aesthetic does not matter at all. And we are all about content. We just need comfort and we need things that work.
That makes me want to talk a little bit more about your cookbook and sort of the recipe development side of this, because I agree, like, people, when they buy a cookbook, they trust that those recipes are going to work for them. So first, can you tell us a bit about the cookbook that's coming out that you're working on? And then I would love to hear kind of about that recipe development and testing process.
Yeah. So it's called Jew-ish, and it's going to be coming out March next year. Luckily, because of the fact that we got the shoot done in time. If not, who knows? The whole thing probably would have gotten pushed, but time was really on my side on this one. And it's kind of all about modern Jewish recipes surrounding a kind of millennial approach to Shabbat, which is something that's near and dear to me. I didn't grow up like very observant or even having Shabbat with my family. But when I met my husband, and the book is also, it's like a quasi love story since it's this kind of blending of cultures and families. I'm Ashkenazi, like classic New Yorker. My husband is an Iraqi Persian Jew who's grew up in Florida. And the kind of gist is that when we met, like, he didn't know what babka was. He didn't know what gefilte fish was. He had never like had any of these dishes. And likewise, I had never had any of these other inherently Jewish dishes from the diaspora that had just never been exposed to me. So we started to kind of figure out what Jewish identity was going to be for us. And that ended up not being like joining a synagogue, but instead hosting Shabbat, which I was doing through this nonprofit called One Table, which is this incredible organization that I'm now actually on the board of, that does just that in terms of helping empower people in their 20s and 30s to figure out a Shabbat practice that works for them. So it was something that I knew I always really wanted to write a cookbook. And this was just the thing that was closest to my identity that I wanted to write about. And it just was very easy from there. A lot of the recipes were either dishes I've made at Shabbats or then recipes that I just kind of thought in my head of weird mashups of different either flavor profiles or things that you wouldn't really think would work with Jewish food that just do. And then in the testing process, actually, I spent a year, almost a year, more like 9 months, developing, and they were all pretty much tested at Shabbats I was hosting. So I wanted to make sure that the recipes not only worked, but they worked in an entertaining setting, since that's such a, like, a huge part of not only this book, but of like what Jewish food and Jewish hospitality is. It's about kind of providing for others and nourishing others. So like, for example, the dessert section is probably the largest of the book because there's a whole like thing about not only there, this is a book for you, but if you are entertaining all the time, great, you have all these recipes. You also need like recipes for when you are a guest, and the whole concept of like not showing up empty-handed, and here are the recipes to make when you are a guest at someone else's table and need to bring something, even if they don't ask.
Jake, this is Hannah. I have a question as a fellow New York Jew, which is, I think if there's one thing we're like weirdly good at, it's feeding people in a crisis.
Yeah.
And I would love to know what, like, if you could shout out like a particular dish or something that like brought you comfort that you cooked from home during these like weird quarantine Shabbats, because there is like a very kind of like nice synchronicity, especially with like Passover happening during all
I was
of
just
this.
Gonna say Passover was actually probably the most like important part, because the Passover menu itself is inherently comforting, and when you add on the concept of like this was the first year, and I typically do all the cooking for both nights. Even if like one night with my, we don't even like split families. We've just continued to grow, and it's my family, my husband's family, and my husband's brother's wife's family, who's also like New York Ashkenazi. So it's like three different families all together. And we'll do everything from sometimes it'll just be all Ashkenazi food. It'll be all Persian food. It'll be a mix of the both. And I think that the idea behind making a giant brisket for four people was so cathartic and comforting. And then we had brisket, and then the next day I made like, I do brisket pasta the next day, which is, I mean, cause we don't keep Passover with the exception of Seder. So we just use, which is like one of my favorite things I write about in the book, of cooking pasta and then using the leftover brisket sauce as pasta sauce. And
yum.
That's a really great one. But then the funny thing that I actually didn't make this year, mainly because I just cooked a year's worth of Jewish holiday foods during my cookbook shoot. And this was at the very beginning, and I'll say nothing beats matzo ball soup. Like, that's truly always will be everyone. I feel like that's like the perfect, that's like the perfect icebreaker question that everyone uses, and they always think they're going to get something like wild from me, but the answer is like a Jewish deli. It's like, it's matzo ball soup, pastrami and rye, brisket, latke. It's like, that is my deathbed meal. And this year, actually, I didn't make matzo ball soup because I wanted to have this kind of hybrid Seder where I made latkes, I made brisket, I made like a bunch of roasted vegetables, but I also wanted to have half of, and I made dessert, which I can't say because it's this one Passover dessert that I made that is, it's like, it's going to be the equivalent of like Alison Roman's, her cookies. Like, this Passover dessert is going to be like the Passover dessert to end all. And
can't wait.
Yes. But the thing was, is that I wanted to have also the ability to kind of like support local restaurants that were still delivering and or serving in New York too. So I'm friends with the owner of Shelsky's in Brooklyn, which I'm a big fan of theirs. And he dropped off matzo ball soup and gefilte fish and horseradish on his way to drop off his meal for his mother in the Upper East Side. And it was one of the best matzo ball soups ever. And I got to kind of get a loaf of gefilte fish from the gefilteria, which makes the best gefilte fish. And then the next night I got some stuff from La Niorquina, from Fanny Gerson's spot. And she made these like brisket stuffed tamales. And it was just a really nice way to kind of really go with the theme of what Passover means in the sense of community.
That all sounds so great, and I cannot wait to get my hands on this book when it comes out, because it just seems like it's going to be so many amazing things mashed up into one. And I also think that, well, I'm hopeful that when it does come out in March, that we're in a very different place in the world then, and people are really going to be wanting to gather. Hopefully it'll be safe then, and what a great kind of collection of recipes and ethos to put out in the world at that point.
Yeah, that's the goal.
Yeah. Well, let's take a really quick break, and we'll come back and we'll talk more with Jake, and then we're going to challenge you to our little virtual happy hour game that we have created out of thin air in the past couple of weeks. We'll be right back.
My name is Brandon Hoy, co-owner of Roberta's, a super duper awesome place. Roberta's is a very, 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 very proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. We're also super awesome. Thank you, Heritage.
Okay, welcome back to HRN Happy Hour. We're here with our guest, Jake Cohen. And we were just talking a little bit about, you know, the past month or so. We've celebrated Passover. It's, you know, we've been about a month and a half into quarantine, lockdown life. And Jake was talking a little bit about what he's been cooking and ordering in and things like that. But I'm curious, Jake, what are some other sort of like everyday things you've been loving to eat and drink?
I've been making pasta probably 4 to 5 times a week. The only thing that has to change is the shape. Other than that, everything else can stay the same. But it's been, I think it's been funny because I can see based on, that's one of the beautiful things of Feed is that we can see like what people are cooking just based on the fact that I get tagged in people making my recipes. And it's all been baking. I will say everyone is baking right now, as am I. But there were 3 recipes I developed, and I actually developed them at the very beginning as these kind of concepts of what are going to be the ones that people can make from their pantry that are super just like easy to make, great to eat in large quantities. And the first is these chocolate brownie, like these brownie cookies with other like olive oil brownie cookies that are so easy, so good. Don't use up any butter if you can't find it. And are like very customizable. The other one is this olive oil cake, actually 2 olive oil recipes because I don't know. I feel like everyone has oil, no one has butter. And it's this like berry swirl olive oil cake that you can use like fresh fruit, any fresh fruit you have, any frozen fruit, like lose all of it and just like throw in chocolate chips. You could do whatever the hell you want. And it's just like a really easy snacking cake that doesn't need a frosting. And then these granola cookies, which are kind of like an oatmeal raisin cookie, but instead just like throwing in random dry goods from your pantry. So like whatever nuts or dried fruit you have. Those have been all like super, super popular. And I mean, other than that, pasta for sure. I never do this, but like I posted a picture. I made rigatoni alla vodka for dinner the other week, and I posted a picture. It was actually this thing for God's Love We Deliver, and like Gail Simmons had like challenged me to do this via Mike Anthony, and there was just like I put the recipe in the caption, which I never do. And there are like dozens of people who are making this recipe just from an Instagram caption, which I just never knew that people do or cook from that. But they did, and that's been kind of another little revelation that people are kind of just down for just anything simple as long as you could just walk them through.
Yeah, totally.
I gotta say, I've been living on loaf cakes. Like, I probably made like a loaf cake like once every 6 months before quarantine, and now I make them like every couple days. Like,
what is a loaf cake?
Like a banana bread or pumpkin loaf.
Yeah. I mean that's the idea behind snacking cakes. Snacking cakes are all in right now, and that's what like the swirl one is. It's like the only thing is instead of a loaf, it's an 8x8 because I need more than a loaf's worth of cake.
I just made my second iteration of Erin Jean McDowell's banana bread that uses 4 bananas. Which is how many black ones I had on my counter, incidentally.
That's the right number.
And
banana bread also uses. I mean, I'm a big, this is always going to be an Erin Stan account because she was on the first episode of the Feed Feed podcast. She sent me ice cream during quarantine. She was like, she sent all of her friends ice cream during quarantine.
Wow. Oh my God. My hero. This banana bread, it has like a Demerara sugar crust on it, which is just like makes it fun to eat like piece number 3 and 4. Like sometimes when you are on your 4th piece of banana bread, you're like starting to get uncomfortable. But like the crunchy sugar between your teeth, you're just like, this is fine. This is fresh. I'm good. And then there's this yogurt. I've been kind of hoarding yogurt because I'm like, I don't know, it's not going to run out. But I just feel like more secure if I have several quarts of Greek yogurt. And there's this French yogurt cake on Epicurious that uses up a whole bunch of it and is really delicious. And you put in some lemon zest, and that's just good because you're like, I'm healthy.
I actually use yogurt in my banana bread.
I do too.
Yes.
You need to have, it's like yogurt or buttermilk, like something, you need something with acidity.
I just want to humble brag that on Monday I made banana bread with a tahini chocolate swirl, and it was transcendent. I don't think I could replicate it again because I just made it.
That's actually the worst part is that I have in this funny enough since we had made everyone else work from home that last week at Feed Feed of when like New York was starting to kind of blow up, and that was when I was shooting my cookbook too, so it worked out well in the sense of like it was a small team just at Feed Feed. But at the last day I was kind of not only wrapping up a shoot and cleaning up, but also cleaning up in the sense of no one's going to be here for who knows how long, so I'm like, and at this rate that had like two weeks I just started driving to work just because I'm a lunatic and Jewish hypochondriac. So I stuffed my car with kind of whatever I could in the sense of cleaning out the fridges because everything's going to go bad. And the last thing I need is like, A, the power to go out or something, and or B, it just like rots and then we get back to this like fridge of mold. So I cleared out most of everything, took what I could. But the thing that I forgot is I had this giant tub, like an industrial tub of tahini at the office.
No.
And now in my fridge, I have a ton of Cetaphil tahini, but it's only the herb tahini. So it's like wonderful for cooking, but I can't bake with it because it just has like random woody herbs blended in.
Woody Earl.
A long story for a very minor problem.
It is weird, though. I, like, packed up my stuff to go on maternity leave, thinking, like, I would be back in April, and I was obviously not back in April, and now I'm just like, I didn't pack thinking I would be gone indefinitely. Like, definitely have some stuff there that I thought I'd be getting back to.
Yeah.
Also, there's all this online yoga. My yoga mat's in the office. Like, really, I was really on top of it.
So we talked about, like, quarantine eats, but what about, since it's happy hour, what is everyone drinking now, or just in general?
So it's funny. I actually don't drink. I'm as New York Mag calls Cali sober. So it's this funny situation where I do actually have a full bar, but we aren't drinking cocktails. It's been bad for the other end of Cali sober, in the sense of when you're just home doing nothing and making snacking cakes. But my sister's fiance works at Google and is this like nerd engineer. He's not Jewish, but we always joke that he's the most Jewish one of us all. He refuses to buy a soda stream, so he gets industrial canisters of carbon dioxide and has, like, finagled a way to, like, use old, like, Diet Coke bottles to make his own seltzer.
Okay, so this is what I do, because I really missed having sparkling water.
I mean, that's it. That's when I tell you there, it's really, really bad when you hear it. And we try not to say this too often to people. But my husband refuses to drink flat water. He will only drink sparkling water or coconut water and nothing else.
Wow.
It's a very expensive habit, but we are getting by. I think that our cocktail of choice is like soda and bitters. So mm-hmm. Luckily we have tons of sparkling water and I have tons of bitters, and then we call it a day.
I think that's the way to go. It makes me think of, have you seen the book that's coming out by Julia Bainbridge? That's
of course.
Yeah, I'm really excited about that. It looks, and the cover is incredible. The artwork they did there is incredible.
Gorgeous.
Yeah. Well, what about everybody else? What's in your glass?
At this point, nothing, because that's a problem that I have. I always consume my happy hour beverage way too early, and last week when it was the margarita, that was just an issue. This week it's the it's Taproot Brewing Company's Doppelbock. Taproot is one of the breweries that is on the island I currently inhabit.
Nice.
I already had a lunch beer. I had lunch at like 3:45, I was ready. So I had a half of a Tributary Brut IPA. Our good friend Todd Mott in Kittery, Maine, is still making amazing beers. If you're in that area, or if you're not, the release of Mott the Lesser is coming up, and they're doing an online lottery, and they will hold it for you for up to 6 months from the pickup date. If you are out of state, Maine does not want people who are not feeling well to come in, and there's a 14-day quarantine, so just wait and pick it up in a while. It's a good aging beer anyway, but that was my lunch beer, and now I'm double fisting a Somm Tea and a Negroni. Happy Thursday.
Love it.
Hannah,
I have demolished a glass of Vino Verde, which was very nice. Nothing fancy. We are out of gin.
Me too.
No.
We finished the liter and a half. So yeah, I don't want to talk about it.
Oh
boy.
The funny thing is that I'm going through my vodka like crazy because of Alavaca. Because of Alavaca. So it's become this thing where I'm almost out, and I'm gonna have to start to figure whether I start using flavored vodka or gin to make the sauce.
Ooh.
Whoa.
I want to hear about pasta alla gin.
I mean, I'm pretty confident it would still be delicious.
Yeah.
I don't know. How wacky do you go on those vodka flavors? Because I want to hear about your, like, chocolate ganache, vodka penne.
it's pinnacle whipped. No, I'm kidding.
Oh no.
It's a little too, it's like a, what is it? It's Belvedere, it's the Belvedere peach. So I think it's a little extra for that, but.
It's not, yeah, it's not first choice.
Throw some basil in there.
That's true.
It does, well, I feel summary. Like eventually, yeah, in the summer season, that'll feel right.
For sure, for sure, that for sure. That will feel right. I'm going to save that one for pie crust.
Yeah, there you go.
Ooh.
Dylan, you ran to get a cider.
I am drinking a cider. I'm drinking a West County cider called Jubilee. And my sister got me a cider club for my birthday. And this is my latest gift from there. And it's very good.
That sounds great.
Dylan, do you have an update for us from last week? Because we were brainstorming some cocktails for you.
Yes, I do. I made myself a simple syrup in a jar, so that was a great first step towards my cocktail journey. And I made myself a nice mezcal simple syrup fresh grapefruit cocktail after we talked last week. So that was a big success, and we'll see. I'll keep you updated for next week.
That sounds awesome.
I was good, but you know, you don't get as much juice as you think out of an entire grapefruit. I thought I was going to make enough for me and my sister and then put enough alcohol for two people. And then it was just all for me because there was not that much liquid in that.
Yeah, blame the grapefruit.
Yeah, but you can just cover it up with simple syrup and you don't even know how much you're drinking.
I'm having a real problem with like not being able to find limes down here that have any juice in them at all. Like those hard, dry limes. It's not great for me. I right now am drinking a bottle of Pusta Libre, Pusta. It's a red, dry red, but it's like pretty funky and tart from Austria, and it's quite delicious. This is from my Brooklyn wine stash
that arrived through.
No.
The redacted. Don't worry about it.
Carried it from Brooklyn.
Yeah. Yes. Just carry one case from Brooklyn, but that only lasted for a little while. So,
yeah.
The flying fairies are bringing us more. Yeah. So this has all been great, and I have like so many more food and drink ideas now. And Jake, I'm with you. We've been slowly moving to the pasta routine. And like have been doing like Alfredo and stuff like that. So
it's just so hard to get meat these days. And like I'm only so I haven't. I mean, I think the part I kind of left out of this entire conversation is I physically haven't left my building in 3 weeks now.
Wow.
Just because like if there's no need to, I would rather not. Especially since I live in Queens and this is like the epicenter of all of the madness. But with that comes the kind of like super, I don't know, hustle to get a like fresh director food kick slot.
I'm right in that with you, Jake. Fresh direct Hunger Games is like a huge part
truly.
Of
though the big revelation has been Norwich Meadow Farms from the Green Market is like doing house deliveries. So I have my delivery coming tomorrow. You can only get one like. When it first launched, you have to wait like 2 weeks. Now you only have to wait a week to get your delivery. So that's been nice to at least have like a fresh produce.
That's awesome.
Okay, so it's the time of the show where, Jake, we have a new little game we've been playing because normally we would do trivia, but we realized we have an opportunity since we're not all physically in the same space that we can play a version of 20 questions with our guests. So what that means is that in the room that you're in, you're going to look around and you're going to find an object. Once you have that in your mind, let us know. And then we're going to play 20 questions and try to figure out what that object is. So let us know when you're ready.
Okay.
And we can only ask yes or no questions. And I'm going to keep count. We only have 20 questions. Take it away, anyone.
Is it decor?
No.
All right. Almost every week it's been decor, so I just figured I should start there.
Is it consumable?
No.
Are you there? That's not a question.
Are you in your kitchen?
Yes.
Is it in the kitchen or is he in the kitchen?
No, wait, I don't. That seems. All right.
Well, I asked if he was in the kitchen, assuming that the object would be in the same room as
it
him.
It could be an open floor plan, and now we have to waste an entire question on the floor plan of his house.
Let us fight about the questions for a minute.
Is it edible?
I already asked that.
Oh, shit. I'm sorry. Redacted.
Count, count it.
The answer is no.
Count it.
Well, that's like broader. If it's not consumable, it's not edible.
Is it bigger than a bread box?
I mean, I think that pick another item to have the comparison to.
Is it bigger?
Why?
Just because I feel like a bread box is so vague in terms of, it's not like, no, not like no, a standard.
He's misleading you. He obviously picked a bread box. Boom, we're done.
I do not have a bread box. That's how you know everyone's home with their parents, is that there are bread boxes.
Yeah. Is it bigger than your head?
Yes.
Are you saying Jake's head is about as big as a bread box?
No, I just went for a different measurement. Oh.
Is it a tool?
You could say.
Okay.
Do you apply heat to it?
Yes.
Is it a Dutch oven?
Yeah, it is, actually.
Really?
It's those Le Creusets, you know? They just catch your eye, and all of a sudden you want to be like, oh.
100%. It's a big red Le Creuset.
Oh, so guess who owes us sponsorship dollars now?
We love Le Creuset.
This episode is brought to you by Le Creuset.
Invoice them.
Kat, how many questions was that?
It was 8 or 9.
No, is that a record?
Really good job. I think it is.
We had to cheat last week to get it under 21.
Oh, God.
Wasn't cheating.
Nicely done. Wow. Jake, will you send us a picture of your Le Creuset so we can use it as the episode art?
Of course.
Nice.
Okay. Will you spend hours food styling that image for us?
I will not. It will be empty. And actually, I am cooking something in it tonight, so maybe. Oh,
nice.
You might get lucky.
Well, Jake, tell us what you gave us a little bit of a tease for what's coming up on the podcast, but any other things we should keep our eye on for new content from the feed or any news coming down the pipeline?
I mean, it's going to be more of the same. I think looking forward, even like what the world is going to look like post quarantine, which I'm trying to be an optimist, but I also think that this is going to change for a long time, how we cook, how we digest content, all of that. So I think we are still going to be just focused on helping people just have recipes for empowering them in the kitchen. And then after restaurants reopen, it's going to be figuring out how we can support that. I mean, like right now we are trying to pivot a lot of our influencer campaigns to offer work to chefs that are out of work. And I think it's going to be a lot of kind of that thought going forward, is how can we support this industry so it comes back stronger than ever when all odds are against it.
Totally. Yeah, that's great. I think we are, you know, in the same boat as you and just trying to stay on top of what's going on and provide content that's helpful to people. And, you know, we've been talking a lot about how some of our content is really focused on covering the news aspect of this and the impact on the food system. And then a lot of the content we do, which I think, you know, your podcast falls into this category, is like offering people some really useful information, but also maybe a little bit of an escape from the 24/7 news cycle. And I think a lot of people are finding that escape in their kitchen. So thanks for doing what you do and for introducing us to your guests, who I think are great people to be following along right now to get some nice recipe inspiration and to helping build this community around food. It's awesome.
And I guess my last kind of note about where everything's going is I feel like this has been rightfully so, an existential crisis for people in every corner of the country. So I would not be surprised if, as people are starting to cook at home, they're starting to realize kind of these passions for food or drink or hospitality or any kind of sense of creativity around the kind of food landscape and what that's going to look like post COVID. Yeah. I have no doubt that there's going to be a whole new realm and class of chefs, content creators, podcast hosts, bread bakers, etc., who only discovered it because this situation made them rethink what is important and what they actually want to be doing.
Yeah, that's something great to keep in mind. Like, I think you're right. I think we're talking to a whole new group of people right now, which is exciting. It's an opportunity for us, for sure. Well, everyone, thanks so much for circling around our laptops for happy hour. And Jake, thank you so much for being our guest of honor this week.
Truly, thank you so much. Such a pleasure.
Yeah. All right. Well, we'll look forward to that Le Creuset photo, and we'll see everyone next week.
Thanks, everyone. Mm-hmm. Till next week.
Thanks, Jake.
HR and Happy Hour is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.